Matthew 7:1, Applying Scripture. The ninth talk in a series titled Reading the Book, Lessons in Understanding the Bible, was presented by Ron Julian on May 29, 2001, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
This is the next to the last session in our class, as I reckon it. We have been talking about how to be a good reader of the Bible. We've been trying to pick various examples, passages to look at to exemplify some of the issues that I think are involved. Tonight, I want to talk about, in particular, the topic of application. We hear a lot about application. In Christian circles, if you are involved in a Bible study, you're not going to be able to go very long before you're going to find somebody pushing for the application. How are we going to apply this passage to our lives? Now, that's good. I mean, that's a good thing, to take what it is that the Bible is saying and actually have it make a difference in the way I live my life. That's a good thing. That's what we ought to do. To read the Bible and not have it make a difference in how I live my life would mean that the Bible either has nothing to say that's relevant to my life, or else I'm choosing to ignore the things that it has to say that are relevant to my life and treat it as just an interesting book to entertain myself with. So, of course, if you have any question as we come into this is whether I'm pro or against application, I'm pro application. Having said that, there can be an awful lot of foolish stuff that ends up happening in the name of application. What I want to try to illustrate for you tonight is how I think we ought to approach this process. What kind of a process is it? David Crabtree has captured the thought that I want to talk about tonight, I think, very well, when he says, we don't apply a verse, we apply a worldview. And that's what I want to talk about tonight. What does David mean by that? We don't apply a verse, we apply a worldview. Now let me give you an example of the sort of thing I'm talking about. We could start off with something pretty simple. Thou shalt not kill. That sounds like a pretty straightforward sort of statement, sort of easy to obey. It says, don't kill, and I obey it by not killing. That would seem to be a pretty easy one to put together. But when you start to think about it, you realize that actually there are problems. If we just take thou shalt not kill as this rule, this is okay, you're not going to kill, we have these situations that we have to start sorting out. What if you're a soldier? Does that mean that you shouldn't be a soldier? That you couldn't be a godly, obedient person and be a soldier? What if you're a policeman? Does that mean that you couldn't be a godly, obedient person and be a policeman? But what if you're an Israelite and God has commanded you to go into the land and kill all the Canaanites? Now what are you going to do? Because you've got God commanding you not to kill and God commanding you to kill at one and the same time, seemingly. What are you going to do if you're Abraham? And Abraham is told, I want you to take your son up on the top of the mountain and take out a knife and kill him. Even something as straightforward as thou shalt not kill can't exist in a vacuum. It is not just a rule that I can pull out and say, okay, there's the rule, and I'm just going to go off and mindlessly do it. It is something that I have to apply out of a perspective on life. There are bigger issues involved with it. Now, am I saying so when it comes to thou shalt not kill? The fact is, actually, it didn't really mean it. You can just go kill whoever you want any time. That's how we apply it. No, of course, I don't mean that at all. But if I'm going to put together a picture of reality that makes sense, certainly if the Bible is coherent, I'm going to have to be able to put together both the commandment not to kill and statements like God commanded the Israelites to go into the land of Canaan and kill the people who were there, put it together with the picture of Paul talking about the state as being given the sword in order to execute justice and that sort of thing. Somehow I'm going to have to put those things together. In other words, I don't just have a rule, thou shalt not kill. I have a picture of reality that thou shalt not kill fits into. But there are these other things that fit into that picture as well. And in order to understand how I ought to live, I have to understand really the way God looks at his creation. What does he want me to think about things? Now, I've talked about this in this class before, I'm sure, but let me just briefly remind you that we find in the teaching of Jesus some great examples of this very sort of thing. For instance, when Jesus is debating with the Pharisees about the Sabbath, the Pharisees are saying, in essence, look, we've got verses in the Old Testament that say to keep the Sabbath. I mean, I believe we talked about this. I lose track. I can't remember if it was here or in church I was talking about this, but we have some pretty strong statements in the Old Testament about the penalties for not keeping the Sabbath. And yet, when Jesus is interacting with the Pharisees about it, he comes back at them and says, well, but haven't you read? And then he starts whipping out these passages that don't have anything to do with the Sabbath. Haven't you read about where David went in and took the showbread that it's not lawful for him to eat? Haven't you read where it says, I desire mercy and not sacrifice? Haven't you read about how the priests in the temple work on the Sabbath? So what we see Jesus doing is saying, you guys have taken those statements about the Sabbath and have run with them without having fitted them together into the bigger picture that God has in mind. You don't understand why he commanded to keep the Sabbath, what its limitations are, what purpose it had, what God's values are that he wants you to be pursuing. All you've got is this idea, we've got this rule, and if we keep this rule, we're okay, and if we don't keep this rule, we're not okay. Jesus' response to them is, haven't you read? And the striking thing, as I've pointed out before, the striking thing is that several of the passages that he says, haven't you read, have nothing to do with the Sabbath at all. But they do have to do with getting a perspective on how God looks at his creation. What does God value? Mercy over sacrifice. How should we think about the religious rules that God has set up? Well, we see a picture of David violating them with impunity. How should we think about that? Jesus is saying, you've got to bring that all together if you're going to understand the particular statements about the Sabbath. In other words, I would say, Jesus was modeling for us this picture that you don't apply a verse, you apply a worldview. It's not enough to have a verse that says, keep the Sabbath. You have to have the picture of things that God has, that he has given us in his revelation of himself, so that we have perspective on things that includes where the Sabbath is coming from. Same thing is true when it came to the issue of divorce. The Pharisees could point and say, look, we've got a commandment that says it's okay to give a certificate of divorce. And Jesus says, well, yeah, but haven't you read in Genesis? And he goes and looks at where God had set up marriage. So again, it takes that. You can't understand what Moses was doing when he gave when he allowed for a certificate of divorce, unless you understand what marriage is and is supposed to be from God's perspective in the first place. You have to see the bigger picture. Well, I would argue that that's always true. That everything we encounter in the Bible, I can't just take it and say, okay, there's the rule that I've been given. Now I'm just going to run with it and go do that or not do that or whatever it says. Because those statements, those commandments, those prohibitions are coming out of a picture of things that is what God really wants us to have. It's not just that he wants us to know a set of rules. He wants us to have wisdom, which means seeing things the way they are. So my goal is not to have memorized the do's and don'ts so much as it is to be getting a picture of what is valuable and worth pursuing, what is not valuable and I should stay away from, what are the principles that I ought to be operating out of, what is a human being, who is God, what has God made me to do in my life, and that sort of thing. The great example to me when you think about how it is we have to think about the passages that we're reading and how we're going to apply them is when you look back in the Old Testament, we see a commandment like love your neighbor as yourself in Leviticus, immediately followed by a commandment having to do with not mixing two kinds of fabrics together. Some of you have heard me talk about this before. But if you're just reading along, you say, okay, love your neighbor as yourself, don't mix two fabrics together, blah, blah, blah. I mean, you know, the rules as they're set out seem to be, okay, well, I've got 357 of them, and rule 352 is love your neighbor as yourself, and rule number 353 is don't mix two kinds of fabrics together. But clearly that's not what God had in mind. And in fact, even the Pharisees of the time of Jesus understood that there were commandments that had more priority, that had more importance, that were saying something more fundamental about things than others. They asked Jesus, which is the greatest commandment? And some of the Pharisees who asked these questions were in agreement with him about the answer. Love God and love your neighbor as yourself. Those are the great commandments. Meaning that what those commandments encompass, what they describe, get more closely to the heart of what it is that God wants from us than a commandment like don't mix two kinds of fabrics together when you get dressed. Now, does the commandment in the Old Covenant about not mixing two fabrics together, does it have a purpose? Yes. Does it mean something? Yes. Would it be significant for me to try to understand what it was that was being communicated in that commandment? Yes. Is it appropriate for me to recognize that since I am not a Jew under the covenant that Moses gave Israel with God, that I am not being asked to follow that covenant, I'm not being asked to refrain from mixing two kinds of fabrics together? Yes, I think so. It means we get into, you know, quite rich theological questions when we start trying to sort this stuff out. But there's no question but that we ought to recognize that there's a difference, even though they're only one verse apart, there's a great difference between love your neighbor as yourself and don't mix two kinds of fabrics together when you get dressed. Well, what is it that allows us to recognize that difference? It's not that there's a flag on those verses. There's nothing that says, this one is the one. I mean, how is it that the Pharisees could read the Old Testament and rightly understand that? And when Jesus explained to them, they'd say, yes, you're right. That's true. It's because up to a point, they were reading the Old Testament and they were recognizing that there are places here where some fundamental truths are coming out. In other words, they had perspective. They were gaining some perspective on what it is that God values, what it is he's really pursuing here. But part of the problem that the Pharisees had is that they didn't understand that very well. And in a lot of the decisions they made about how to deal with and apply what was found in the Old Testament, they misunderstood the purpose of what was there and ended up distorting it into something that it was never intended to be. Well, what I want to do tonight is talk about a real simple passage, in a sense, just as an example of the kind of issue that we run into when we set out to apply something in the Bible. The passage is Matthew 7:1. Do not judge, lest you be judged. You're in this situation, you have a friend, and that friend, you discover, is having an affair with another, a mutual friend's wife. When you talk to people about, should I say something to this person? Should I step in and try to do something, talk to him about what he's doing? Your Christian friends tell you, don't be so judgmental. Who are you to judge this person? What, you're perfect, are you? Look at what Jesus said. Do not judge, lest you be judged. So you have no business passing judgment on how he's living and telling him that he's doing wrong. The question is that a good application of that verse or not? Is that what I'm supposed to take away? It says, do not judge, lest you be judged. Pretty simply and straightforwardly, it would seem like, okay, sure. So I hear what you're saying. It's not my business to pass judgment. You go ahead and have an affair. That's your business. It's not for me to say that it's wrong, because Jesus told us that we should not judge. So that's the question I want to talk about. When I come to a passage like that, do not judge lest you be judged, how is it that I'm going to decide what to do after I've read it? What am I actually going to do in my life? How am I going to live out the thing that this passage is talking about? As I said, I think what we're trying to do is to get a picture of the way things are. How does God look at the world? What is true? What are the values that we are being called to pursue? What are the truths that we are being called to acknowledge and submit to? And what are the implications of those truths for the decisions we make along the way? So, somewhat artificially, I just want to propose some of the picture of reality that we get from the Bible that I have to bring to bear on a statement like, do not judge lest you be judged. How is it that I get perspective on what it is and is not saying? So, somewhat arbitrarily, my first observation is that as I look around in the Bible, it seems pretty clear that we are called to discern the difference between evil and good. At a minimum, as a believer, I am being exhorted to pay attention, see what is evil and stay away from it, what is good and pursue it. One passage that came to mind is from Ephesians, chapter 5, verse 5. For this you know with certainty, that no immoral or impure person or covetous man who is an idolater has an inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and God. Let no one deceive you with empty words, for because of these things the wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience. Therefore do not be partakers with them, for you were formerly darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Walk as children of light. For the fruit of the light consists in all goodness and righteousness and truth, trying to learn what is pleasing to the Lord. And do not participate in the unfruitful deeds of darkness, but instead even expose them, for it is disgraceful even to speak of the things which are done by them in secret. Okay, so here's Paul. It seems, there's much we could talk about in that verse itself, in those verses, and we're not going to go there, but clearly I think we can see enough to see that Paul has in mind that we as followers of God are supposed to be making a distinction between evil and good. We are not to be participating in evil, but instead do not participate in the unfruitful deeds of darkness, but instead even expose them, it says. And we could do a study in this passage to see what the word expose, is that a good way of translating it? We might argue that maybe there would be a better way to translate it. This word is sometimes translated condemn. Sometimes it's translated convince. We could debate, what exactly is it that I'm being called upon to do? Condemn the unfruitful deeds of darkness? Convince people that are involved in it that they should not be participating? And we would have some work to do to figure out exactly what Paul means there. But I can see enough to know he does not have the attitude that, it's just evil. Don't make a big deal out of it or anything. I mean, his attitude is, it is a big deal. It is something that I need to tell the difference between one and the other. At least for my own sake, I need to be able to tell the difference between one and the other. And I'm not to participate in it, but instead somehow to challenge it, to work against it. We are to call evil, evil. And we could find a lot of examples. I mean, that's just out of a hat. We could find a lot of examples where we are clearly called upon to make a distinction between evil and good. Then I'd make a second observation as I look at the Bible and I see the kinds of things we're exhorted to. I find that we are called upon to urge our brothers to abandon evil. One of the really famous passages is in Matthew 18, where Jesus makes this point. He says, "And if your brother sins, go and reprove him in private. If he listens to you, you have won your brother. But if he does not listen to you, take one or two more with you, so that by the mouth of two or three witnesses every fact may be confirmed. And if he refuses to listen to them, tell it to the church. And if he refuses to listen even to the church, let him be to you as a Gentile and a tax gatherer." Okay, pretty serious response that Jesus is calling for here. It involves recognizing, seeing that someone else is sinning, as he puts it. It involves going to that person and talking to them about it, reproving them in private. And if he listens to you, you have won your brother. You've rescued him back from the dark road he was going down. But you keep pursuing it until ultimately, if this person refuses to acknowledge the evil of what they're doing and tries to defend evil as good, ultimately, he's saying, you stop treating them as one of you. Let him be to you as a Gentile and a tax gatherer. Pretty strong language. Paul also makes a comment about reaching out to someone who is in the midst of doing evil. At the end of Galatians in chapter 6, he says, "Brethren, even if a man is caught in any trespass, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness, each one looking to yourself, lest you too be tempted." So, in this passage, clearly Paul is urging humility, the spirit of humility and gentleness, the idea being, don't approach this person out of a sense of superiority, thinking that you've got it all together or you're immune from the temptations that this person has succumbed to. That would be foolish. But a person who is caught in a trespass, Paul is not saying, well, so say, just ignore it. Let it go by because you don't want to be judgmental. He's saying, restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness. Definitely, we're being called upon to point out the evils that the person has fallen into and to encourage them to come back. And we could multiply examples of this. James, at the end of James, says, "My brethren, if any among you strays from the truth and one turns him back, let him know that he who turns a sinner from the error of his way will save his soul from death and will cover a multitude of sins." Okay, so each of these passages we would have to look at and try to get more specific idea of what exactly is involved in the context and so on. But I think there's enough here. I would argue, having looked at these passages in the contexts in which they fall, I would say that we are right to see this idea that Jesus, Paul, James, they all have this idea that when a person is sinning, when they are deliberately giving themselves over to evil, that it is appropriate for the others in the community to talk to them, to seek them out, to try to restore them, to encourage them to abandon the way they're going. So, unless we're just totally misunderstanding what those verses are talking about, and I don't think we are, it doesn't make sense to say that being judgmental means talking to somebody and telling them that they are in the wrong, that they are doing evil for what they've done, because the Bible encourages me to go to people who are caught in evil and talk to them about it. Jesus says not to judge, but he also says to go reprove your brother in private if he's sinning. Paul talks about not judging, lest we be judged. He picks up that same sort of idea that Jesus talks about, but then he talks about if someone's caught in a trespass, then you go to them, you restore them, gently, humbly, but nonetheless you're seeking to win them back. And James is very insistent about being merciful, and the one who is not merciful will not receive mercy, and so on. And yet, he talks about turning the sinner from the error of his ways. So, somehow, these two ideas must be able to work together. That it must be possible to be a person who would reach out, who would call a spade, who would see evil in evil, and would even talk to another person about it, and yet not be judgmental at the same time. Whatever being judgmental means, it doesn't seem to mean that. Okay, now I make a third observation about the worldview out of which this is being spoken. The commandments against judging, for instance, the Matthew passage that I quoted, "Do not judge lest you be judged," in the context, they are connected with the idea of being a hypocrite, with the idea that in condemning someone else, I am really condemning myself. In other words, you know, it's sort of the people who live in glass houses shouldn't throw stones kind of idea. If you're going to be judging someone else, you had better watch out, because it's going to come back on you. Jesus, when he says, "Do not judge lest you be judged," he immediately goes on to say, "For in the way you judge, you will be judged. And by your standard of measure, it will be measured to you." That's a crucial part of the statement, "Do not judge." It helps us to see the sort of thing that he has in mind. He's saying, whatever measure you use is going to be used back on you. Now, I already know that when it comes to myself, the Bible certainly is urging me to be ruthless with myself, to look at evil and say, that's wrong, to see in myself if there is something evil about the way I'm living, I ought to look at that and say, that's wrong, and I ought to turn away from it. So, there doesn't seem to be anything wrong in my own life, in how I deal with myself, with looking at the reality of my own evil and saying, that's evil. I don't want to be condemned. I don't want to end up facing judgment and condemnation. But I do want to discern the reality of either evil or good in my own life. And I think that's what Jesus is getting at here. By your standard of measure, it will be measured to you. If I see evil in my own life and call out to God for mercy, God, I shouldn't be this way, but I'm counting on you to forgive, to raise me up, to restore me, to forgive my sins and lead me into life? Am I being judgmental with myself? Well, I would say no. I'm being discerning about the reality of sin, but I am also grateful for the reality of mercy and forgiveness. What Jesus is warning against is that double standard that says, oh, well, you know, whatever faults I may have, we can excuse those. Those aren't that big, and, you know, we can overlook those. But boy, are you messing up. He's saying, by the standard with which you measure, it's going to be measured to you. If your standard is, you have messed up and you ought to pay, then what's going to happen is the standard that is going to be used against you is, you have messed up and you ought to pay. Remember the parable that Jesus told about the servant who's forgiven this huge debt, and then he won't turn around and forgive a much smaller debt that another servant owes him. And the master basically accuses him of a hypocrisy. Look, you wanted me to forgive this huge debt, but you won't forgive this one over here? Why should I do that? If justice is the standard, if he owes you 25 bucks, then you owe me a billion, so pay up. Or are we talking about mercy? You owe me a billion, but I forgive you. Which are we talking about? In this passage, Jesus is talking about judging in the sense of condemning. Judging in the sense of looking at another person, condemning them in your heart for what they have done, all the while seeing yourself as exempt from the same kind of condemnation. No, he's saying, by the standard of measure you use, it's going to be measured to you. If I look at another person and say, what I see in your life is evil, and I think you ought to turn away from it, but I hope that ultimately you find the mercy with God that I hope to find with Him myself, I'm not judging in the sense that Jesus is talking about. I'm quite willing for that measure to be used against me as much as it is being used against the other person. If I'm willing to say, let's call evil evil and look to God for forgiveness, then there's no hypocrisy. And I'm not judging, I would say, in the sense that Jesus is talking about. We see this same theme come out in other places. Paul says in Romans 2, therefore you are without excuse, every man of you who passes judgment. For in that you judge another, you condemn yourself. For you who judge practice the same things. It's that same idea. It's that hypocrisy, that blindness that says basically, what the other guy is doing, that's reprehensible. But my faults are somehow, you know, I'm just human. What do you expect? Cut me some slack. So, what we see in the passages that talk about judging seems to point us in a particular direction. It's not pointing us in the direction of saying that judging means to discern evil and call it evil. Judging is to take the higher stance, to stand up above and look down and say, you deserve to pay for what you have done. I look down on you and condemn you. Because in taking that stance, I am a hypocrite. Because I, who am standing up here looking down on them, actually am in the same place. I'm at the same level. And if I'm condemning them, then what in the end is going to happen to me? Okay, so those are some of the observations that I make as I look around at the Bible. There are others, there are many others really that we could bring together to try to get a picture of how God is looking at things. Let me just sum up for you some of the things that I think I see that come together as I try to apply this idea of not judging. My picture of things from the Bible is something like this at this point. First of all, I am called to follow the truth about what is good and what is evil. And so I'm being called to be discerning about the good and evil of my own actions and that of others. I see that very consistently in the Bible, a picture of not excusing evil, not calling evil good, not pursuing evil, not ignoring evil, but being concerned about goodness and being clear about what's the difference between good and evil. Because one of the key values that the Bible has is the idea that we are being upfront about the truth, that we are confronting the truth, that we are accepting the truth. I picture it as like bowing the knee to truth. The truth about myself, the truth about the world, the truth about God is being paraded in front of me, and I'm submitting. I'm saying, yes, it's true. I'm not denying it. I'm not fighting it. I'm not trying to turn it into something it's not. I admit it. That's the way things are. And so one of the fundamental truths that we're being asked to confront in our lives is the truth about what is good and what is evil. Another one of the principles then I see is that I am a sinner, just as the person I'm dealing with is. I cannot condemn the other person, for then what do I deserve? I have to leave room for mercy. If there's room for mercy for me, then there's got to be room for mercy for the other person. I am called upon to love others as myself. That is, I should do for the other person what I believe is best. I am being called to pursue the welfare of other people. Even my enemies, I'm being called to pursue the welfare of. So I'm trying to think and do what would be the best thing for that person. If I were in his shoes, what do I think would be the best thing to be done for me in that spot? And that doesn't necessarily mean being loving, doing the best thing for the person, does not necessarily mean ignoring evil or not calling them to account. Because the best thing for a person caught in sin is to be told about what is wrong and mercifully called back. And that's what we keep seeing. That's what Jesus said, that's what Paul said, that's what James says. It's a pretty consistent picture. Ultimately, they're going around down a road that leads to death, and the loving thing to do is to try to call them back. But in the process of trying to call them back, there is a way that you can go and try to call another person back where you take the stance of the superior one, the one who is above such things, who in essence condemns rather than entreats and forgives. And that stance is a spiritually dangerous place to be. Because if you're going to take that stance and say, I'm above you, the fact is it's a lie, and you're not above them. And what the judgment that you are calling down upon them may end up coming upon you. That's the picture of things. That's the worldview that I think has to be applied. I can't just take do not judge and run with it, because it might mean any number of things, and some of those things are not what Jesus really had in mind. The way I find the implications of a statement like do not judge are by coming to understand what I keep calling the bigger picture. Not being judgmental is a value, if I come to understand what that means, but pursuing good is a value. Calling other people back from sin and error is a value. Being forgiving is a value. Being discerning about what good and evil are is also a value. And these set of values are going to be working together. If I take any one of them and just turn them into a rule, I am likely to distort it and to turn it into something that is actually disobedient and ungodly. That's what Jesus keeps telling the Pharisees that they have done. They have taken the Old Testament law and turned it into something that it was not intended to be. And in doing that, you have the delicious sort of irony that I can be obeying the commandment while I am disobeying God. Because the commandment isn't obeyed by just pulling it out, taking it and saying, oh, okay, I'll just do that. The commandment is coming from some place, it has something to say, and it is like a brick in an edifice. It is giving me a principle that works together with other principles to give me a building, a coherent structure that makes sense out of which I can live. That's the point that I'm trying to get across here tonight when I'm quoting David, who says, apply a worldview, not a verse. That's what I mean. What the verse tells me is something that I take and I bring together with the other things that I have learned in life and that I have learned from the Bible so that I have a set of priorities that can tell me how to operate in various situations. This kind of process then can apply to all sorts of things. I mean, I gave you the example here of do not judge. But there are all sorts of things in the Bible that I basically have to approach the same way. Exhortations, examples, I mean, you name it. Paul in Corinthians says, I become all things to all people. There's the model for us. There's the example. Paul is obviously urging the Corinthians to do this. I want you to follow me in this. I want you to become all things to all people. Well, what does that look like? How far does that go? We could be ridiculous and say, so if, you know, if I have a friend, I want to witness to my friend the heroin addict, should we take heroin, you know, should we shoot up together? Of course not. But it's a legitimate question to ask, why not? I mean, it does say, be all things to all people. Paul says, to the Jew I become as a Jew. Why not to the heroin addict I become as a heroin addict? Why not? I mean, you've already recognized that Paul's exhortation is not meant to be absolutized and turned into something that stands on its own as the principle by which I operate. It is a part of a fuller picture of things. Well, what do I see then in the way Paul lived his life, in the context of things? What do I see Paul doing? I see Paul, on the one hand, when he was with Jews, he conducted himself as a Jew. He followed the Jewish dietary regulations, and we see him going to help someone fulfill a vow in the temple, and he does it specifically to communicate to the Jews, I am a Jew, I have not abandoned the religion of our forefathers, I am not anti-Jew. At the same time, when he's with Gentiles, he eats like a Gentile. He eats with the Gentiles, which was, as we've seen, just horrifying to some of the Jewish, even the Jewish believers in Christ, the Judaizers. But, and yet at other times, when something else is at, the Judaizers come to Antioch, where Paul and Peter are hanging around with the Gentiles. They get very affronted by the fact that these Jews are eating with Gentiles, and Peter, to keep them happy, as we've seen, I think we talked about that in here, backs off and stops eating with the Gentiles. Paul doesn't say, well, yes, Peter, we do need to keep these Judaizers happy. We don't want them to be offended. He stands up and he chews Peter out in front of everybody, saying, you shouldn't have done that. The fact is that the very truth of the gospel itself tells us that the Gentiles are acceptable before God even though they are not Jews, and we need to stand up for the truth of that When the Judaizers come around and imply that there's something unacceptable about the Gentiles, you and I need to go over and sit down next to the Gentiles at the table and pick up a hand sandwich and take a big bite. That's what you and I need to do. To show them which side of this issue we're on. To show the Gentiles what God thinks of them. To show the Judaizers that they are wrong in their perspective on what is acceptable before God. So we see in Paul's own mind that the principle to be all things to all people doesn't mean by no means should I ever offend anyone by doing anything different than the way they would like it to be done. He has something less than that in mind. So there's another example. I mean, we could pursue it. And there's all sorts of evidence to put together, even just from the life of Paul. You may have encountered this problem before, that Paul insisted that Titus not be circumcised. And yet, he himself arranged for Timothy to be circumcised. Was Paul a hypocrite? Did Paul change his mind? Well, I would say that there's actually a great consistency in the way Paul conducted himself. And it all has to do with how we understand what he meant by becoming all things to all people. He meant something in particular. It was a particular value that he was pursuing in the midst of many other values. That's not his only value. It's one. He wants to not, as much as is possible, he wants to not be a stumbling block. He wants to not cause problems for people in hearing his message that don't need to be there. But obviously, in Paul's mind, there are a lot of problems that I can cause for other people that do need to be there. They need to have a problem with me. If the Jews were offended by the fact that Paul ate with Gentiles, they needed to be offended by that. Because they were desperately wrong in what they understood the gospel to be about. He wasn't doing anybody any favors by keeping them happy. So, there again, I give that as another example of how do I apply something like I become all things to all people? Well, I apply it by understanding what the principles were out of which Paul was operating, understand the other principles out of which he operated, and try to put together a picture of things so that for myself, those same principles are in operation. I want to stand up for the truth of the gospel, and I want to be self-sacrificing in living my life in such a way that I am being helpful to other people and not a hindrance to them as they're trying to sort out the truth of the gospel. Those are the values out of which Paul lived, and sometimes he was confrontive, and sometimes he just went with the flow, depending on how those things were playing themselves out in the particular situation. In this situation, the truth of the gospel is not at stake, so I'm just going to back off and go with the way people are doing things. In this situation, fundamental truths are being corrupted by what's happening here, and I can't let that go by. I have to take a stand for what I know to be true. So it's not like there's a rule that says always be inoffensive. It's just not true. And actually, there are relatively few, I mean, this is going to sound kind of outrageous, and maybe I would back off of it, but let me just say that my impression is that there are relatively few statements in the Bible that I can take and absolutize, that I could just take it, pull it out, and say, I'll just run with that. I mean, love God with all your heart and soul and strength and all of that. Yeah, there are no exceptions to that that I'm aware of. I don't think that we could find any exceptions where in this situation, though, you shouldn't love God with all your heart, soul, and strength. I don't think it works that way. Even then, though, we have to work to make sure. Do you know what that means to love God with all your heart, soul, and strength? If every time you think about God, you get a warm feeling in your chest and it makes you want to cry, is that what it is? Is that loving God? What if you don't ever get that feeling when you think about God? Do you love God then? I mean, we have to understand what it is that's being exhorted there. But I think we'll find that when we look at that, we're not going to find too many exceptions to that. But most of the time, what we're being given is statements about principles and values that are true, that are unchanging, but they're in a dynamic relationship with a set of principles and values. It is always true. The principle to which Paul is appealing when he says, I become all things to all people, that principle is unchanging. But basically, when you go back, the principle that it comes back to is love your neighbor as yourself, which is I am always called upon to do. But the idea, I become all things to all people, is not an absolute statement of what I ought to do in every situation. It is a general statement about how Paul applies the principle of loving his neighbor as himself in certain kinds of situations. And we could just go on and on with this kind of thing. In the end, as I said at the beginning, the Bible is not giving me a set of rules that I'm supposed to follow. It is trying to foster in me wisdom, to give me more and more clarity about life, about who God is and what His values are, and who I am as a human being, and who you are as a human being, and what the value of the things around me in the world are. The more that I come to understand who I am, what God wants of me, what He created me to be as a human being, what the relative value of things are, as I'm getting that sort of hierarchy of values in my mind, is marriage a good thing? Yes, marriage is a good thing. I'd say the Bible presents marriage as a good thing. Is marriage the ultimate thing? No, marriage is not the ultimate thing. Ultimately, I see in the Bible Jesus giving me a call that says, I would ask you to follow me in such a way that it overrides any human relationship that you have. If your marriage was in the way of following me, then you should follow me instead of being married. If we're commanded to love our parents, but Jesus says, nobody who doesn't hate father and mother is worthy to follow me. Well, how do you put that together? I'm supposed to love my parents and I'm supposed to hate my parents. Well, it's because there is this hierarchy of values that I find in the Bible. I am called upon to honor my parents and love them because it would be the height, I mean, at a minimum, I would say, it would be a mark of ingratitude on my part not to recognize what I in fact owe my parents. As bad as they may be in various ways, I owe them something. And an acknowledgement of that is appropriate. But at the same time, it's not an absolute. It's not honor your parents, therefore overlook when they do evil, turn a blind eye when they're committing horrible acts. If God calls you to leave your home and follow Him someplace else, say, no way, God, because I'm going to honor my parents. It's not like that. It is a value among values. That's the way life is. Jesus commended the person who gave a cup of water in His name. But I don't think I ought to give a cup of water to a drowning man. It just doesn't make sense. It's not an absolute. It is a picture of the living out of certain priorities and values in the midst of life. But those priorities and values are going to be applied in different ways depending on what the situation is. Paul says, look, you guys, get along with each other. Don't be passing judgment on each other's differences of religious opinions. I know some of you think you ought to eat this, and some of you think you ought to eat this, and just put up with each other, accept each other, get along. Each of you will stand or fall before your own maker. Let's not get so upset about this stuff. And then he turns right around to the Galatians and he says, you know what? Anybody who preaches a different gospel than what I preach, let him be accursed. Over here he's saying, don't worry about whether you ought to eat this stuff or not eat that stuff. It's no big deal. And over here he's saying, if anybody teaches you that you have to eat kosher or be circumcised or something like that, let them be accursed. I'm telling you, Jesus will be of no use to you if you listen to them. So, what I'm trying to say is, it's always like that. I want to leave time for questions here, but I want to make this last statement. It's always like that, and in saying that, I am not saying that we believe in the bad part of what some people refer to as situational ethics. There are absolute truths. God's character is unchanging. Reality is reality. And I believe that firmly. But the unchanging character of God lived out in life is going to do different kinds of things in different kinds of situations. It's not just a mechanical stick in one of these and you get out one of these. The issue is what are the things that are coming together here? What's at stake? So, in the end then, when it comes down to applying verses from the Bible, I recognize that what I'm saying involves really a lifelong project. What I'm saying is the first time you open up the Bible and point your finger and it says, don't trim the corners of your beard, you're kind of stuck. You don't know what to do with that. I'm just telling you, you don't. Is God going to be happy with me if I stop trimming the corners of my beard? Is that what it's about? Maybe. I don't know enough yet to know whether anything I do with my beard is going to make God happy. All I know is that I have that statement in there, and it's coming from someplace. It's part of a bigger picture, but I don't know what the bigger picture is. And the more I read, the more I get familiar with the revelation that God has given, the more I start to get sort of the landmarks. You know, I recognize, I may not have the details down, but I'm starting to recognize that there's that big mountain over there, and you know, we got to this big building over here, and I'm starting to see the major features of things. The first ones, hopefully, that emerge have to do with loving God, loving my neighbor, my need for mercy before God, the mercy that is to be found in what Christ did on the cross. I mean, those are the things that start to emerge with clarity. And the principles that have to do with life, what's true, how God looks at His creation, those things are going to come together and make more and more sense as I go along. I'm just saying, I mean, you may reject what I'm saying as being, oh no, that's not practical, that can't be true. But that's what I'm saying. In order to be a person who applies the Bible, I have to be a person who is becoming wise. That is, I'm starting to get the idea about what the values of God are, so that when I encounter situations that may be very different from something that I find in the Bible, I have an idea of what the values of God are that I can bring to bear on that. You know, when we some of the issues that we encounter in our culture today, we don't actually have a whole lot in the Bible that speaks to them. Even a hot button issue like abortion, I don't have a lot of biblical evidence to work with. But is it the case that the Bible has nothing to say that would help me sort out how I ought to think about something like that? I would say no. But I don't have very many verses that I can go to and say, oh, see there, see, that proves that you're not. It's not like that. It's coming to understand what God has created us to be, how He wants things to function, what it means to be submissive to God as a creature before my Creator, what it means to value my fellow creatures, what the commandment against killing meant, what kind of a person it is calling upon me to be. It's when my values are coming into place that then this new phenomenon, I mean this phenomenon that's not really addressed much in the Bible, I can look at and say, I think I can see what's going on here and how I ought to proceed. Because I don't have a specific commandment concerning it, but I have a model of the values of God and the priorities of God, and those priorities help to steer me as I'm sorting through this stuff. Okay, well, on and on and on. Let's take a few minutes then for any questions or comments you may have.
I have a couple of things I want to ask you. At least the first one. You've been telling us about, how to look at things in different ways, or reading the Bible, how to go along through the King James system, how to compare Old Testament, all these things. And I'm also wondering about, as someone who's studied and been doing this for a long time, about talking with other people. Like right now I can talk to you and ask in this kind of setting, but like among people who are just really maybe just beginning to really get into the Bible, and, where do you put that as far as importance in discussing, look at this verse, I think I've always heard it kind of emphasized this way, I wonder because of this and that if it looks like this. I mean, how does that fit in with really getting deeply into Scripture?
Okay, I'm not quite following the question. How does it fit in what way? Are you thinking about yourself as you're talking to other people?
Yeah.
How should you talk to them?
Among friends, that's kind of why I say I have two things. Among people, you might be with people who are all really interested in, let's go deeper into what the Bible says, but maybe no one has, degrees here and there and knows that much about what they're saying. They're just kind of, wanting to look more into it. And then you may be with friends and relatives who are very much into the Christian religion, but bring up something that, you just... like, this doesn't sound right, the way this verse is emphasized, but I don't want to get on a soapbox and start preaching when I don't even know that much.
Right.
How much does discussion come into these things?
Yeah, there are two very different kinds of issues, I think, that I'm hearing, if I'm understanding your question here. I should say, before I start to answer this, that my intention next week is to, in some ways, to address this question as well as... what I want to do is sort of step back and ask the practical question, what is it that we're expecting you to do with all this stuff that I just have been talking about in this class? I mean, where do we go from here? And this issue is a part of that, and I hope it comes out some more in my comments next week. But I want to answer your question now. I would say that in general, what we want to be is truth seekers. What we want to be is people who are concerned to know what the truth is. That means that wherever it is I'm standing, it's not so much a question of how far have I gotten in figuring out the truth, but am I willing to turn around and face the right direction and move as best I know how in the direction where I think truth lies? The issue is more fundamentally the question of my own heart and disposition towards the truth. I'm going to talk about this more next time, but it's pretty apparent that in the way God does things, that his concern is not to give everybody this shot of instant understanding of everything. I mean, that's not the way it works. That there's this great value in the process of pursuing this. So, talking with other people about what's happening, if I'm dealing with people who likewise have a concern about what the truth is, then it doesn't really matter, I mean, how much knowledge we have or how many degrees or that kind of thing. We can always ask some questions and make some progress towards something. I mean, if only to say, you know, I've always heard that this passage means this, but lately I've been wondering if maybe it doesn't, because it doesn't quite make sense to me. You know, or you know, today the pastor said, he was reading from the King James Bible and he quoted where Jesus said, "Suffer the little children to come to me," and he said that meant it was okay to beat up on children and make them suffer. And, you know, as I think about it, I'm not sure that's what that passage means. Well, that's good. I mean, maybe I don't know any Greek, and maybe I'm not in a position to argue and to make a complicated argument about the background of the passage and that stuff, but I have a mindset that says, I believe that God is there. I believe he's revealed himself in the Bible. And that means this is an important book that means something to me. So I'm going to take the next step. And if I'm together with a group of people who are interested, then yeah, I think that kind of discussion can be incredibly valuable. It may not solve all the problems, but see, to my way of thinking, having a discussion where you have more questions at the end than you had when you started is a good thing. I know that can seem kind of frustrating, but actually, to not have questions where I ought to have questions is a worse place to be. It's better to have those questions, because then I know what I'm dealing with, and maybe I can make some progress along the line towards getting them answered. But if I don't know their questions, or I don't have those questions, then I'm never really going to pursue them. So with people who are interested in making that journey with you, I think it's great. I mean, we ought to be doing that. I mean, I'm sure that you all could agree with me that we together don't do that sort of thing enough. That, you know, at my little birthday party yesterday, we found it very easy to all sit around and have a conversation about which of the Star Wars movies we thought was the best. And I'm not embarrassed by that. I got right in there and I told them what I thought. And it was my party, so hey, I was allowed to do that. But, you know, you understand, I'm not down on that. That was fine. That was a fun thing to do. But it does occur to me that it wouldn't be such a bad idea for a group of Christians sitting around to talk about, like, so what did Paul mean in that passage? Paul, the apostle sent from God. Paul, the one who's proclaiming the message that has to do with my eternal destiny.
George Lucas does not hold my eternal destiny in his hands, but Jesus does. So maybe I ought to figure out what he was talking about.
I mean, that, you know, so I'm all for that. And I want to emphasize this again next week, but I do not want anything that I have said in this class to make reading the Bible this task that only experts are fit for. That's not what I'm trying to say. What I'm trying to say is if we're going to be truth seekers, we need to think about the Bible in these terms. We need to be patient. We need to let ourselves take time and recognize, you know, maybe I don't know yet what this passage is talking about, and that's okay. The other side of the coin that you were talking about, when I'm in those situations where I'm talking to somebody and I feel like they've got a pat answer from the Bible and I'm not so sure that that's really what it's talking about, and yet there really doesn't seem to be the opportunity to pursue this without, you know, just, I could say, oh, I don't think that's what the passage is saying, and make them feel stupid and shut the conversation down or something. Those are always hard calls. I don't know. I've never felt like I make those kinds of judgments very well, when to speak and when not to speak. I think we need to be humble. We need to recognize that we don't know everything. Even if we're right about, in this particular case, I think I need to think about it with the kind of values that Paul brought to his discussions. What's at stake here? How much do I think, you know, to the best of my understanding in this situation, how significant is what I see as the problem and what the person was saying? Can I be creative and show how I would approach the problem without getting, without kind of being in that sort of superior, oh, you're so stupid, here, let me show you how it ought to be done kind of thing? The key is, what's the point? The point is, I want to be a seeker after the truth, and I want to love God with all my heart, and I want to love my neighbor as myself. Those are the positive values that I am pursuing. So if there's a way that I can be helpful to this person in talking about this stuff, then I want to try to do that. Sometimes, though, it's very important to recognize, just imagine the hypothetical situation that you agree with me about what I've been saying in this class. Just imagine, you know, just for the sake of argument, imagine that somehow you've been convinced that we ought to approach the Bible something like what I'm picturing in this class. Can you see that for someone who's coming at the Bible from a very different place, the sort of person who has been taught to take the Bible and cut it up into separate verses and stick them in a box and pull the verses out one after a time and say, this is my promise for today. It's not going to do any good to get in a shouting match about what this particular passage means, because the problem is we're not pursuing it the same way. We're going to have to back up and talk about how we're doing it before we can actually do it. So it's hard. I have never exactly known how to do it, but a lot of times where there are those differences of perspective in theology and what a passage is saying and that kind of thing, it's the rare situation, if it's a serious disagreement, that we're going to be able to solve the disagreement by just looking at the passage or talking about it, because the problem is farther back. The problem is, what is it I'm looking for when I look at a passage? How do I decide whether I know what the passage is saying or not? And sometimes what you find is that there's a very different perspective on that. I find that. I mean, whether I'm right or wrong in what I'm saying here, there's no question that I'm doing this differently than some people do it. Maybe they're right and I'm wrong, but we can't both be right, because we're doing it very differently. So we're at an impasse when it comes to the passage itself. We've got to back up and kind of talk about, how do you do this thing? And that can be a long-standing discussion. That can take a long time to just kind of make it clear how are we approaching this so that we know where we're taking different turns. How did you end up over there and I ended up over here? It's because way back here we came to a fork in the road that we're not talking about, that we ended up taking different roads. And we're really going to have to go all the way back to that fork and talk about which one of those roads should we take in order to come to agree together about what's going on. So, how do you do that? I don't know. The main thing is, I know for myself that I am way too inclined to be impatient with people that I disagree with, to think myself superior to people that I disagree with. And I can tell you that that sort of attitude is going to get you absolutely nowhere. I can testify. It doesn't get you anywhere. And it shouldn't, because we shouldn't be taking that kind of attitude. But God is in it for the long haul with us. So I think with each other, we need to be in it for the long haul as well. Just, you know, bit by bit, try to sort it out. But it is worth doing. I mean, just take, you know, little baby steps here and there. Be like Jesus. Tell a parable. Tell a story. And they go away thinking, boy, I don't get that story. I wonder what that was about. A year later, they'll finally figure out what you meant in your little story, and they'll go, oh, okay.
Many times when you do a lot of research and study and get a fairly good handle on the subject matter, even though it's deep and broad, like you're talking about, with understanding, a superior attitude can pop up pretty easily, especially if you get into a debate mode. Mm-hmm. And the key to stay out of it is obviously prayer, it's submitting yourself first to the Lord, but it's that human fleshly temptation to show yourself. You've done your work. You've done your homework. And you're going to lay it out.
And there's a certain resistance. Nobody wants to be wrong. Uh-huh. I mean, if the other person who's disagreeing with me, they're saying I'm wrong. And that's an offensive thing to say.
Yeah.
The best thing, I mean, I'm not very good at it, but I have been a Christian long enough to know when I go into teaching or when I'm talking to people about various things, the prayer that I have before God is that I would have the attitude of trying to be helpful to other people and not have this be about me, because I'm very inclined to make it be about me. How do I feel? I mean, I don't know how much of this stuff you guys do, but I stand up in front of people and talk a lot. I have been doing this for a long time. And nobody wants to be a fool. Nobody wants to stand up in front of a group of people and look like an idiot. So, you know, there's going to be that time. I know it. It's already happened. Those situations where you get up and confidently say something and somebody comes back and points something out and you realize, oh my gosh, they're right. I was wrong. And there's a real temptation to not want to go there, to not want to admit that that's the case, because it makes me look like such an idiot. I just said that it was true and this person comes along and says that it's not. So there, to be able to disagree, to have a conversation where we're getting on the table, let's get out there what we're talking about so we know what it is we're disagreeing about, and yet be concerned in the midst of that for the other person. This is not, I want to win this argument, but rather, I want us to be truth seekers and let's pursue this together. If and when it can happen, it is a great gift from God, because that's a really phenomenal thing. And it doesn't happen very often. And part of the reason it doesn't happen very often is because
I mean, for me, I don't experience it very often because I'm there. And when I'm there, you know, there's at least half of the people who have a problem with their ego and need to be working on that. And then there's always the other guy. It's not unlikely that he may have the same situation. And between the two of us, we can mess it up pretty bad. So to actually be able to be in that spot, I have, every now and again, I encounter somebody that I do not agree with, but we can actually talk about the things that we don't agree about and make some progress. Listen to the other person. Actually, one of the things that you can do if you're trying to be helpful to another person is to make sure that you make it your business to listen to them as well as talk to them. It's not just your job to make sure that your ideas get heard, but it's your job to make sure that you're hearing theirs. Even if they're wrong, how are you going to understand what they're talking about and why they're thinking what they are? And since you don't know automatically that they're wrong, what if they're right? How are you ever going to find out if you don't take the effort to try to understand what they're saying? So, just like the Bible, understanding it is a long-term project. Understanding each other is a long-term project, I think. And I suppose that's, in a way, that's my, what I'm trying to urge us to do as we approach the Bible, just as I would urge us to do it as we approach each other, is to be patient, to not be so results-oriented. I've got to have the answer right now, and I've got to convince you that I'm right right now. But to be more process-oriented in the sense of, I want to be a person of character while I'm pursuing the truth. I want to care about the truth while I'm doing it. I may be more right regarding this issue than the other person, but I don't have it all right. I've still got a lot to learn. I'm not going to learn anymore if I take the attitude that I've got it all together. I'm not going to help them learn anymore if they pick up the attitude that I've got it all together. So, in the end, that patience says, it's a way of trusting God right where I am. I think God knows what He's doing. I can count on Him to get me to the end result, and meanwhile here I am now with how much understanding I have now and the people I have around me now, and I can just work with that. Did that like get anywhere even close to the question you were asking?
Yeah. Not always, but a lot of times I am just impatient, more faster.
Right. Well, I didn't mean to be accusing you of impatience. That's not what I meant, but
I see that myself.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we have one more session. Yeah. That's good.